This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Does Ford have a future? Hello again, I'm Norman Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The Ford Motor Company is following General Motors with factory closings and brutal layoffs in North American operations. CEO Bill Ford, the great-grandson of Henry, says he plans to fight Toyota and win. Skeptics say he's not confronting the real cost of union labor and that it's too late to go green. On To the Point, a financial crisis that dramatizes the pressures of globalization and the decline of American manufacturing. We'll talk about health care, pensions, the environment, economic inequality, and what's hot in the world's biggest market for cars. On Reporter's Notebook later on, has Canada turned to the right? First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Norman Olney, back with To the Point. Ford says closing 14 factories and laying off 30,000 workers is the way to fight Toyota and win. On To the Point, can Ford's way forward deliver as promised, or is it the road to Chapter 11? On Reporter's Notebook, in Canada, conservatives have ended 13 years of rule by the Liberal Party. Will President Bush have a more supportive ally? First, this news update. As expected, the Judiciary Committee has sent Judge Samuel Alito's Supreme Court nomination to the Senate floor. On a strictly partisan vote, 10 Republicans yes, 8 Democrats no. Jonathan Darman is editor and correspondent for Newsweek. He covered the Alito hearings. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Warren. Thanks for having me.
Only one Democrat, Ben Nelson of Nebraska, says he will vote for Alito. What are the chances of a filibuster?
I think they're pretty slim at this point. You never know, because any senator could exercise that prerogative. The Democrats could pull off a filibuster. I think it's unlikely that the Republican Party in the White House would get the 60 votes necessary to override a filibuster, but I think most Democrats have concluded that it's in their political best interest to make their opposition to the nomination known, but not to go ahead with the filibuster, because if they were to sustain it, they think that they might take a large hit politically going into the 2006 midterms.
So they still, however, plan to use this incident politically. How do they do it then if they haven't gone all the way to the filibuster?
Well, I think the way you use it politically is the great motivating force in American politics, abortion. There is now this perception that Roe v. Wade is closer than it's been perhaps at any time in 30 years to being overturned. This is something that gets forgotten, of course. If we assume that Judge Alito gets confirmed and replaces Sandra Day O'Connor, and even if he would vote, as we would assume he would, to overturn Roe versus Wade in a certain case, that doesn't mean that Roe versus Wade would necessarily be overturned. Justice Kennedy, of course, has in the past affirmed parts of the Roe decision. So we don't know that we would have that sort of moment of a real watershed in American politics, but that is a big motivator that both parties are going to try and use, that the sort of change moment is within reach, and they're going to be talking about that a lot in races around the country this year.
Talking with Jonathan Darman, general editor and correspondent for Newsweek magazine. So what then is the strategy by the Democrats? Do they just want to keep the vote as low as possible?
I think that's right. You were right to mention Senator Nelson. It'll be interesting to see if anyone else goes over. There might be a couple of other red state Democrats. Also, there might be some Republicans from the Northeast, like Lincoln Chafee, Olympia Snower, Susan Collins, who've so far been unclear about what their position is going to be on Alito. They are in a tough bind because they are Republicans, but they are pro-choice, and they get a lot of money from pro-choice Republican groups. So if Alito is effectively put out there as the face of the pro-life movement now, which, I mean, there were some pro-life supporters rallying in Washington over the weekend who were certainly quite supportive of him, it's going to be hard for them to square their vote for him, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the next couple of days.
There is, as I understand it, on the calendar for the Supreme Court, a partial birth abortion case that might be decided before the elections. Is everybody waiting for that to see what Judge Alito might do?
Yeah, I mean, I think Judge Alito is really going to hit the ground running, assuming he does get confirmed. I think, you know, we might be surprised. Judge Alito, in his confirmation hearings, made such a big deal about his commitment to following the letter of the law and interpreting the Constitution and statutes. He's not someone, I think, who will always is going to be jumping at any chance he gets to overturn Roe versus Wade. He, like a lot of justices who perhaps are uncomfortable with the Roe decision, is going to be looking for the right case to do that with.
What about the timing of his confirmation? The president wants to have it before Tuesday when he delivers the State of the Union speech. Is that possible?
Yeah, I think that's possible. The Senate could vote on this by the end of this week, and then assuming he is confirmed, the president would certainly, in that instance, probably do what he did with Chief Justice Roberts and swear him in right as soon as the vote occurs, and announce the nomination, in which case he would be sitting there watching. But you never know; things could play out in this week. We could be surprised.
You mentioned Justice Kennedy. Certainly, there will be a change with Sandra Day O'Connor no longer on the court, if it is only by making a different justice the likely swing vote.
Yeah, and I think, you know, everyone's focused on abortion. There are some others where the swing issue will really come into play. I think the executive authority and the war on terror issue is the most clear one. There was, of course, the 2004 case, Hamdi versus Rumsfeld, where Justice O'Connor was the key vote in the majority, in a 5-4 majority, saying that the U.S. government couldn't detain terror suspects indefinitely. And Judge Alito certainly would seem, from his past statements on the role of the executive, to differ from Justice O'Connor on that. So that's an issue where you could see his role really playing out quickly and affecting Supreme Court.
A lot of questions about that at the hearing, a lot of bobbing and weaving by Judge Alito, as many people have pointed out. Jonathan Darman, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks a lot for having me.
Again, editor and correspondent for Newsweek magazine. In a moment, does Ford have a future on To the Point?
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, Manali, back with To the Point. Henry Ford invented assembly line mass production, and he paid his workers enough that they could buy the cars they were making. Now his great-grandson, Bill Ford, is about to close 14 North American factories and lay off 25 to 30,000 workers because the cars they produce aren't selling. Dan Neal is Pulitzer Prize-winning auto critic for the Los Angeles Times. Dan, always good to have you on our program.
Hi, Warren.
What's wrong with these cars?
Well, that depends on which cars. You mean the ones they have been building lately?
Ford, yeah, why don't the Fords sell?
Well, Ford went through almost a decade of kind of product neglect. At the end of the 1990s, they were making a lot of money on SUVs and big trucks. They didn't put that money back into product development, so you had a lot of static products. The trucks, the Ranger trucks weren't developed. The Taurus stayed, kind of frozen in amber for a while. And so now you're sort of seeing that loss of market share as a reflection of, you know, the lack of new product.
How long does it take to recover from something like this, particularly with the Asian companies, most, of course, Toyota, coming on as strong as they are?
I think the sooner the better. In fact, one of the things that makes me optimistic about Ford, and I recognize that I might be in the minority, is a sense of urgency that is new, and a sense of trying to anticipate what the market will be instead of trying to react to what the market is at the moment. And so you have some very interesting projects going on at Ford to develop alternative powertrains and small cars, and they have something called the Piquette Project, which is a sort of a green car Skunk Works, recyclable, alternate power, that sort of thing. I think they're moving on all fronts.
Well, isn't this what Bill Ford said he wanted to do a long time ago but hasn't been able to do?
Yeah, Bill Ford came into that position in, I think, October 2001, sounds like. And he wanted to make it the green car company. Well, the first thing he did was he had plans to stop building the Ford Excursion, which was this, you know, monster vehicle that that really offended the sensibilities of a lot of people, much like the GM Hummer H2. But there was so much money involved in building that vehicle. And then Ford had Firestone and the Explorer issue, and that cost them a tremendous amount of money. He's really been handcuffed financially in a lot of ways. And that, I think, is changing.
Quick, a reminder to our listeners, the Firestone and Explorer issues, what do they involve?
Well, they involved the fact that the Explorer had a high rollover rate, and there were a lot of accidents involving these cars, and they were on Firestone tires. Ford and Firestone, wound up pointing fingers at each other to assess the blame. There was a lot of it was a very costly thing to settle in court for these companies, and it was a cash drain, and I think also a tremendous distraction in 2003 for the company.
So what would you expect then next up from Ford after this announcement? Pretty grim for the workers involved, obviously. What's a new Ford going to look like? How soon are we going to see something really innovative?
Well, I think, Ford was the first company that had a hybrid SUV. It was a modest effort. That was the Ford Escape Hybrid. I think you're going to see that Ford Bill Ford's already said he's going to offer something like 250,000 unit hybrids in America by 2010. So they also have the Reflex concept car, which they showed in Detroit, which suggests that Ford brand is going to have a small, compact, what's called a B-class car. They have a really interesting crossover utility vehicle called the Edge, which is going to be launched, I think, next year. And they've already got a really decent little car on the road called the Fusion. I think the Fusion is probably, as product goes, a significant turnaround. This is a really decent car built in North America that competes with Camry and Accord.
Dan Neal, again, won the Pulitzer Prize as an auto critic for the Los Angeles Times. Dorinda Elliott writes for Time magazine. She has this week's cover article on the Ford Motor Company, and it includes an interview with William Clay Ford, Jr., the great-great-grandson of the founder, the great-grandson of the founder, Henry Ford. Dorinda, thank you for joining us.
Hi, great to be here.
Your title in the magazine is, Can This Man Save the Auto Industry? Not just the Ford Motor Company. Why is this so important to the entire industry?
Gosh, well, firstly, it's so interesting to hear Dan Neal talk about this stuff. Dan, who knows a lot more about cars than I do, and I would agree with all the stuff he just said. Why this has significance for the whole car industry is if they can't pull this off, then we may be witnessing the death of the car industry in the United States. I mean, people are talking about the possibility of GM going bankrupt, and, you know, sometimes people even talk about Ford, although Ford is in much, much better shape than GM. One thing that Douglas Brinkley, the historian who wrote the book Wheels for the World about the Ford Motor Company, said to me was that if Bill Ford pulls this off, he could go down in history as a real historic figure. If he doesn't pull it off, then he could just be a guy who watched over the collapse of a family company.
Why is Ford in better shape than GM? GM's plan sounds a lot the same with the closings of factories in the United States and laying off of tens of thousands of people.
I think I would argue that the difference is about the corporate culture and the culture and the sort of cultural revolution that Bill Ford is trying to launch at his company. You know, Bill came in as, it's funny, he's such a contrast in personalities in the sense that he was, on one hand, he's a prince, he's the heir to this great-grandson of Henry Ford and the heir to a billion-dollar fortune. On the other hand, he's a rebel who, from the minute he came into the company, started, as Dan was saying, started saying we need to be an environmentally friendly company. He doesn't want his family's name to go down in history as being known as the family that was America's great polluter. And so he has, you know, perhaps belatedly, but he has realized that this is a change or die situation. There's real honest talk here. As he said to me, you know, there hasn't been a lot of honest talk in Detroit or in the auto industry or at Ford Motor Company, and that has to change. And he realizes that they have to really blow up the culture at Ford Motor Company, which had become extremely bureaucratic. You know, the sort of manufacturing guys and the business plan guys had gotten in the way of the designers and prevented, you know, sort of bold designs to try to kind of be everything to all people. And that's got to change. They've got to do some, you know, make some cars that are going to excite people and bring people back into the showroom.
Dorinda Elliott with Time Magazine. Back to Dan Neal with the LA Times. You mentioned a number of the projects that are involved at Ford. But what about the major competitors, particularly Toyota? Aren't they already way ahead? And couldn't we expect something more innovative even yet from them?
Yeah, the only thing that Ford can really hope is that Toyota actually drowns in all the money they have. But that's Toyota's has historically put a larger percentage of its money into product development. That's been built into their culture. They also have a very, very tough corporate culture where you produce or you get out. And you know, you're seeing with Toyota a snowball effect. They really have done everything right, and they have been anticipatory. You know, this is about a mindset. This is about being more secular than religious. You know, in Detroit, it's about, oh, you know, something will save us down the road. You know, Toyota's never thought that. They've always been highly competitive. They've always looked at it as you know, more work to be done, and that's where they stand now. To your question, does Ford stand a chance of catching up with Toyota in terms of product development? I think yes. I think they have the mood in the corporate offices to do that, and they're willing to spend the money and to jump ahead. You know, I really think that what's going to happen is that they're going to leapfrog conventional wisdom and anticipate a market 5 years down the road.
Again, Dan Neal is a Pulitzer Prize-winning auto critic for the LA Times. There is another person, namely our next guest, who says that the way forward, as Ford calls this, is the road to Chapter 11. He is Peter Morici, professor of economics at the University of Maryland School of Business and a former chief economist at the U.S. International Trade Commission. Mr. Morici, thank you for joining us.
It's very nice to be here again.
Why are you so pessimistic?
Well, I think that Ford has fundamental cost problems which keep it from putting out the kinds of products that Bill Ford aspires to create. Its production costs are too high because its factory labor is way too expensive. I don't see a way out of the blue-collar labor cost problem because Gettelfinger can't deliver his members.
Well, who's Gettelfinger?
Oh, Mr. Gettelfinger is the head of the UAW.
Mm-hmm.
He can't deliver his workers if he negotiates a radically different contract. The rather slim concessions he gave Ford on health care passed by a narrow margin among the workers. He really needs a wholly different contract. He needs to get rid of the jobs bank, for example, which guarantees workers their salary and fringe benefits for many years after they're laid off. What's more, they're slower in getting product out than Toyota and Mazda and all the others. You know, for 15 years now, the Ford Motor Company has been promising to reinvent itself and trim down its product cycle and has been failing to do so. The plan that was put forward talks about taking advantage of their global architecture. Well, they've been talking about that since the middle 1990s. They've been second to market in so many areas, the SUV, the minivan, even the hybrid that was mentioned. I mean, Honda and Toyota had hybrids first. Chrysler had minivans and SUVs first. The last big product category that Ford pioneered was the Mustang, and that was when I was a teenager, and I'm 57 years old. So, you know, I don't have the same optimism. Another thing is that Bill Clay Ford is a man of very strong values. He's an environmentalist. He's a political progressive when it comes to many social issues, and he likes to project his values in his company and cars. The reality is Toyota understands the person whose values you project reject are the person that you want to buy your vehicle. And while Americans, you know, like to talk green, they buy brown.
Again, Peter Morisi is now at the University of Maryland. Back to Dorinda Elliott on this one. Again, you talked with Bill Ford. He's confronting the kinds of criticisms that we hear from Peter Morisi. What does he say about it?
Right. That's absolutely right. And I think Peter raises really excellent points. I guess number one, Bill says he agrees that the labor problems, for example, the legacy costs that Ford carries are insane. I mean,
legacy costs, just quickly.
Legacy costs meaning health care and retirement. You know, they've got a huge retirement burden. They carry, I forget exactly what the numbers are, but something like $500 for every, you know, more than $500 for every car they manufacture the cost is accounted for by these kinds of legacy costs. And as long as American workers are being paid with all their benefits and everything as much as $65 an hour, you know, how can they possibly compete with, say, Chinese workers, you know, looking down the road who are making $2 an hour? You know, Bill Ford recognizes that and realizes that some kind of new relationship is going to be have to be developed with the UAW, the auto union, and he says we're at a pivotal point in terms of our kind of deal with the auto union, but it can't be done alone, and so he argues that what is needed is a national dialogue, and he argues that Washington has really not taken this up and is not addressing these issues, which really, you know, we're facing a national crisis, basically. You know, globalization has happened, and the United States and manufacturers have to face that. And so what is the United States going to do to kind of reinvent itself to be able to take on the new challenges? And those are the conversations that aren't happening on a national level.
Dorinda Elliott with time. Quickly, Peter Morisi, we just have a minute before we need to go to a break. But what about this? Does this, in fact, suggest that we ought to be having a national dialogue about some of the issues that you mentioned, including health care and pensions and the rest?
Well, I think we do need a national dialogue, but I don't think the Ford Motor Company should think it's going to get off scot-free, which, for example, national health insurance. Somebody would have to pay for that in the form of higher taxes. Also, their liabilities far exceed the legacy costs and the health care costs. Their cost disadvantage is much larger than that. Also, the Japanese make cars in the United States for less money than Ford does, even if we take out the legacy costs.
And tell us why that is.
Well, the UAW imposes inefficiencies through work rules and the jobs bank. Also, both Ford and General Motors don't seem to be able to design cars as efficiently, as effectively. Their turn cycles are too slow. And Mr. Ford's going to have to do something about that if he's going to succeed. They're going to have to put product on the road a lot quicker than they do now.
All right, a lot of challenges ahead, obviously, for the Ford Motor Company, not to mention General Motors and the American economy in general. We will come back and continue this conversation to focus a little bit more on not just the legacy costs for the big manufacturers, but some of the broader issues, including in national health care, which have been mentioned just in the past couple of minutes. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, has Canada turned to the right? We'll hear about yesterday's election. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Olney back to the point to talking today not just about the Ford Motor Company but about the auto industry. Our subject illustrated by the title in Time magazine of Dorinda Elliott's article, Can This Man, namely Bill Ford, Save the Auto Industry? A lot at stake here with Ford cutting 25,000 to 30,000 jobs in North America and shutting down 14 factories as well. Jared Bernstein is senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. That's a progressive group in Washington. Served in the Clinton administration as deputy chief economist for the Department of Labor, co-author with Lawrence Michel of The State of Working America. Jared Bernstein, good to have you back.
Thank you.
What about what we heard a moment ago from Peter Morisi, that Ford is in a situation here where it really can't recover because of the labor issues, and it's not, with all we've heard about Bill Ford, he really isn't doing enough to do the job.
Well, I probably position myself somewhere in between Dan and Peter on that account. I think I think it's reasonable to draw from some of the things that Dan said that we're certainly looking at a much diminished American presence in terms of our domestic auto industry. But I don't think it's going to disappear maybe in some of the ways that Peter was kind of suggesting. I mean, for one thing, I think Dorinda was also noting that, you know, will the auto industry kind of disappear here? You know, it's interesting to note that employment in motor vehicles and parts, sure, it's fallen over the last few years, but it's fallen at exactly the same rate as other durable manufacturers. And in fact, you know, some of the jobs that were lost and will be lost at Ford and GM are going to be picked up by the some of the Japanese implants that are here now. So I think we will continue to have an auto industry. I think it'll be more of a niche industry in the sense that Dan was talking about. I absolutely agree with Peter that some of these impossible cost issues that are just incompatible with global competition will we're watching them disappear. We're watching the beginning of what will ultimately be their disappearance if the industry will survive.
What are the prospects that Mr. Gettelfinger of the UAW and his members will make the kinds of concessions that might be necessary to meet the standards raised by Peter Morici?
Well, I'm not sure if they'll be able to meet the standards raised by Peter, although in some cases they may be. I mean, for example, he mentioned the jobs bank. You know, that's going to go. That's a system where workers can get paid even when there's nothing for them to do. But by the way, a little bit of collective bargaining trivia here. That was management's idea, in part to ensure labor peace and to keep a stable workforce during periods of weak demand. So, you know, these collective bargaining issues are agreed on by both sides. So I think they're obvious. Going to be major concessions, you know, my hope is that the union is up to it. I mean, let me make another point in this regard. You know, I think there's kind of a misconception that the jobs in the Toyota plants that are non-unionized are somehow, you know, lousy jobs or at least, you know, much worse than the jobs that the UAW members have. In fact, because of the presence of the UAW and the desire of those Japanese managers not to have the unions in their plants, they pay a comparable wage. It's a few dollars less per hour. Now, their pensions and their legacy costs are much less. They certainly don't have the legacies. They don't offer as good a pension or as good a health care program as the UAW. But those are not terrible jobs.
And legacy, once again, refers to those people who are getting paid in retirement, even though they aren't any longer working at Ford, and those people that are getting big medical benefits as well. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And when you're talking about the Toyotas and such, you know, this is a younger workforce and they just don't have the retiree kinds of burdens that the older manufacturers do.
Jared Bernstein, again, at the Economic Policy Institute. Back to Peter Morici at the University of Maryland. Again, the former chief economist of the U.S. International Trade Commission. Were you suggesting that the American auto industry is going to disappear?
Oh, no, not at all. We make 12 million cars a year in the United States, or cars and trucks, and I expect us to continue to do so for a long time. What I see happening is the transplants expanding, and if Ford and General Motors can't make it and go through Chapter 11, they will be reconstituted much as the steel companies were reconstituted. That something else will emerge. The factories are there. Some of these factories are very good. There's a lot of design talent in Detroit. It can be reorganized. Oh, it makes sense to make cars in North America, and we're going to be making cars for a long time to come. The question is, will the Ford family have anything to do with it, and will General Motors survive as we know it?
Jared Bernstein, we heard a moment ago about the culture of management at Ford. Dorinda Elliott mentioned that. Dan Neal did as well. How is it different from other auto companies? How are the problems of the American auto industry related to mismanagement? Couple of questions.
Well, I think the ability of the management of any industry, and by the way, you could be talking about financial industries, service industries, manufacturing, their ability to successfully adapt to global competition is really the touchstone by which they are going to survive and flourish or otherwise be competed out of business. One could argue that some of the older industries have a much tougher time adapting, but I would argue that that's probably not wholly accurate in the sense that the playing field is really pretty skewed against our manufacturers. I'm talking specifically about the fact that they have a difficult time competing with imports from Japan and China because of currency valuations and manipulations, particularly by Asian economies. When the Chinese ensure that their currency is 40% undervalued, then their imports cost a lot less over here and our exports cost a lot more over there. And that's one of the major factors that, along with the product design stuff we've been talking about, which is, of course, a major factor as well. But that's also really hurt American ability to compete.
Peter Morici, again, you were chief economist at the International Trade Commission. What about that? And is the real competition ultimately going to come from China?
Oh, the real competition is going to ultimately come from China, but we're going to hear from the Koreans first, and they're probably going to take Toyota back to school along with Ford and General Motors. The currency problem is critical. The Bush administration has been unwilling to take the Chinese on. Their currency is 40% undervalued. That puts a 40% subsidy on the car components they're sending here now. And other Asian governments follow suit. They follow China's lead. Korean exports are subsidized because of this in the automobile industry, and a whole host of exports throughout Asia are subsidized into the United States by undervalued currencies, which are maintained by their governments intervening in currency markets. China spends 10% of its GDP propping up its exports. I mean, consider this. Suppose we stop spending money on schools in the United States and put that on the back of exports. We'd be a great exporter. That's what the Chinese do.
Jared Bernstein, earlier Peter Morici mentioned the possibility of universal health care, said that that was just going to make taxes go up in the United States and wasn't going to solve the problems. Do you think that it would be helpful for American manufacturers, Ford, General Motors included, if in fact we adopted universal health care?
Well, not only do I think so, but they think so too. It's very interesting. If you hear an American auto manufacturer give a speech on this side of the border, they don't say too much about universal health care for political reasons. They go up to Canada and they become longingly envious of that system wherein they don't have to worry about covering workers through the job because they have national health care. Now, I think Peter's right that taxes would have to go up, but I think what's important here is that and there's really no way of getting away from this fact. Every other industrialized economy has solved this huge problem, and it's only going to get bigger, through universalizing some aspect of healthcare coverage. Now, here in this country, we spend 15% of our gross domestic product on healthcare. In Canada, it's 10%. If you look at the European, the average of European countries, it's somewhere in that 8 to 10% range. So you have countries spending two-thirds of their economy on healthcare. Now, they may be paying higher taxes, but they're also paying a lot less in their private sector, obviously, to achieve that 5% of GDP gain over us. Now, it's well known, and I think we've talked about it in this conversation, the extent to which healthcare costs are just slamming the competitiveness of American manufacturers, and it's not just cars, and it's not just manufacturers. So, in my mind, we can talk about universal health care as a great, lefty or progressive idea. No, let's think of universal health care as a competitive idea, and I don't think we should be derailed by this notion that it means higher taxes. Keep your eye on the prize, which is the share of the economy you devote to health care. We are on an unsustainable path, and every other advanced economy has figured it out. It's time for us to do the same.
Peter Morici, earlier Dorinda Elliott said it's time for a national dialogue on this kind of issue. Where do you come down on what we just heard from Jared Bernstein? What about these manufacturers talking one way in the United States and another way in Canada?
Well, I think they should talk both ways everywhere. I mean, I think they should speak their minds everywhere they come. I think we need a national dialogue on health care, and it would do a lot to help manufacturing generally. But it's important to recognize that we're basically paying 50% too much for health care. It's a 50% cost disadvantage. General Motors spends $1,500 a car on health care. So if we have national health insurance and they pay taxes to pay for it, they save $500. Will that lift manufacturing generally? Absolutely. Will it solve General Motors and Ford's problems? No, because they're much deeper than that. We spend too much on health care. If we have national health insurance, then we can have a dialogue on appropriately pricing health care. The problem in America is the price is too high. We pay too much for drugs. We pay too much for hospitals. If you think Ford is bureaucratic and have cost problems, take a hard look at your community hospital. That needs to be cleaned up, and it's not getting cleaned up with the present system. So I think Jared and I agree that we need to look at health care.
But in different ways, apparently. Dorinda Elliott, back to you with The Time magazine. You raised this question of a national dialogue on some of these basic issues. What does Bill Ford have to say about this and the Ford Motor Company in general? Ultimately, is this going to be part of what they refer to as the way forward?
I think what's interesting is I think he would agree with everything you guys are saying, and I think all of the stuff you're saying is right. However, what's refreshing about and what I think Ford is getting right now, whether they can pull it off or not, I don't know, but what they're getting right is that they're not blaming the Chinese and the Japanese and their currency issues for their problems. They're not blaming their workers. They're not blaming labor, sort of unfair labor, cost advantages for their problems. They're saying our problems are our own, and we have to change the ways we do things. We have to make cars that people want to buy, and we've got to change our culture. And that is something that Bill Ford has really started. And I think in some ways that's what differentiates himself from the other manufacturers. I mean, he's someone who totally agrees that those broader issues, of course, are huge and that they can't solve their problems by themselves. But he said, look, we have got to focus on we've made a lot of mistakes, and we have to stop right now, otherwise we're not going to survive.
Still with us, Dan Neal, with the Los Angeles Times, Pulitzer Prize-winning auto critic. Earlier, Peter Morici said values are important and that might be a difference between Bill Ford's values and the values of the people he wants to have buy the cars. What about that? Are the values of the buying public changing?
Well, I hope so, but I want to, and I think they will, and I think that Mr. Ford has an advantage is that he has a sense of anticipating those values, especially those values of people who are younger, who are going to grow up with a greater sense of awareness of responsibility of inheritance. But the thing about Bill Ford and these larger issues, what we're talking about is industrial competitiveness. This country does not have a policy of industrial competitiveness. One of the elements of that has to be health care reform. This country is also a hero-worshipping nation. Bill Ford is one of the few people, maybe the only executive that I can think of, who has the standing to go to Washington, D.C. and argue for national health care and make an argument that sticks, and he won't be dismissed as a lefty or a loony. You know, the auto manufacturers had an opportunity to form an alliance of goodwill with the unions years ago on this issue of national health care. The unions backed a Democratic candidate. The Democratic candidate was serious about national health care reform, and basically Detroit, opposed that. General Motors, for example, I think gave almost 70% of its political money in 2002 Republican candidates. Well, now everything has changed, and we're looking at a realignment of these causes and these issues. It turns out that national health care is going to be good for American competitiveness, and it's not a socialist collectivist movement. It's a good thing, and we need it now. And I think that Ford, Mr. Ford, is the guy that can sell the idea.
Dorinda Elliott, do you think that's what he intends to do?
I agree. I think that's exactly, he makes it clear that, look, I got to fix my problems at my own company first, but he definitely wants to start a national debate. He has tried to do so already in Washington. He's planning to continue taking up that cause.
So, Peter Morici, back to you then. Everybody agrees that health care is the issue. You're, however, not sold on the idea of national health care, universal care.
No, I didn't say that. I think that the notion of moving towards national health care makes some sense to me. It might not look like the Canadian system. We might use private providers like they do in France and Germany. But we do need to have a national dialogue about more effectively providing health care, and that may mean a role for the government. However, I don't think we should hold our breath and think that's going to solve Ford and General Motors' problems. They run much deeper than that. At least Bill Clay Ford refreshingly is saying he's got bigger problems than health care. GM likes to blame all of its problems on everyone else. I like the fact that Mr. Ford is willing to take responsibility for the problems at his company. The question is he getting there in time, and can he rid himself of his own values for a while and focus on what customers want? You know, there may be a whole generation of car buyers that will want to buy green 15 years from now, but he better start selling cars people want to buy in 2007, or he's going to be gone by 2010.
Dan Neal, what about that?
I disagree. I think that the change, the sea change in consumer taste is
is upon us now. And the longer that we look at $3 per gallon gasoline and consider the possibility of $4 per gallon gasoline, which, by the way, I think is probably the best thing in the long run for the country, because we've simply got to break the lock of denial that we have about fossil fuel. But what's happening is that it's people are already changing. One thing that the consumers haven't had, particularly, is a choice with a palatable choice with an American nameplate on it. So yeah, there are a lot of people out there who would buy a Ford if Ford offered them the product that they wanted. There are a lot of people out there if Ford built a plug-in hybrid with flex fuel. Now, this is a very forward-thinking idea in propulsion. But if they sold one in 2010, people would buy it. It just for the sheer excitement, the sort of the iPod excitement that would go with such a a progressive product. People want them, and if Ford doesn't offer them, someone else will.
So, Peter Morici, then Dan Neal obviously thinks tastes are changing much more quickly than you do.
Well, the question is, can Ford get to 2010? We can quibble over when the buying public will be ready for these vehicles and when these vehicles will indeed be ready, but Ford has to get from here to there. It's going to have to make its way selling internal combustion engines that people want to buy, and it hasn't been able to do that.
Jared Bernstein, quickly, what about the kinds of dynamics Dan Neal's talking about as a motivator for buying cars?
Look, Dan Neal raised a couple of points. We've been talking about this for a while. We've yet to really talk about the price of oil. The two points that I think underlie much of what we've been talking about is the fact that global demand for oil is high and it's not going away. And two, globalization is obviously here to stay. To the extent to which Ford can adapt and other car makers can adapt to those realities is the extent to which they can survive. My sense is that Dan is probably on track when he suggests that optimistically that's exactly what they're trying to do. Whether they can get there fast enough, as Peter said, is a question. But I think consumers are ready for the type of thinking that we've heard from Dan and Dorinda Ford is moving towards, along with the sense that the government needs to play a role here in helping to soften and ameliorate some of the challenges raised by global competition. We certainly are getting whacked in that battle in the manufacturing sector.
As we said at the outset, enormous number of issues involved here, very important to all of us, and thanks so much to you for being with us. Jared Bernstein at the Economic Policy Institute, Peter Morici at the University of Maryland, Dorinda Elliott at Time, Dan Neal at the Los Angeles Times. Thanks again to everybody. After four Liberal victories in 13 years, the Conservatives won yesterday in Canada's national elections, but they failed to win a majority in the Parliament. In a moment, what will that mean for the Kyoto Treaty, for missile defense, and relations with President Bush on To the Point?
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Herman Alney back with Popota's Notebook on To the Point. Stephen Harper will be more conservative as a prime minister than the Liberal Party's Paul Martin, who lost in yesterday's voting. But despite last-minute claims of extremism in Liberal Party advertising, Canadian voters appear to think that Harper has evolved into more of a centrist than he's been in the past. John Ibbotson is a political columnist for the Globe and Mail in Canada, and thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Is that correct? Has there been, in fact, at least on the surface, a political evolution going on here?
Yes, evolution is the word. It's very important in having these discussions with Americans to remember that we are talking about a political spectrum that is well to the left of your political spectrum. So Stephen Harper is probably the most conservative, the most small c conservative right-wing prime minister that Canada has ever had in its history. He's still to the left of the Democrats in the United States.
On what issues? Why do you say that?
So, for example, he accepts, as all political parties accept, and in fact wants to expand, the national public health care system. Here's a good example. The Conservatives and the Liberals both put forward national daycare programs in which the federal government would be responsible for ensuring that people, regardless of income, would have money to put their children into daycare before they entered pre-kindergarten at the age of four. The Liberals want to actually create subsidized daycare spaces across the country. The Conservatives want to do it in the form of a tax credit. to parents. But both parties assumed the legitimacy and the need for such a program. And I don't think you, in fact, have ever had a debate in the United States over whether Washington should be responsible for a national daycare program. So to the extent that he wants to change Canada's foreign relations, that he wants to reform the tax system, that he has very fundamental and radical notions for realigning federal and provincial powers, yes, Stephen Harper is a very conservative person. But A, he has evolved from where he was when he was the head of a right-wing think tank in the 1990s, and where he has evolved is to the middle of the Canadian consensus, which even so was enough only to secure him a weak minority government, because there's still tremendous concern among urban Canadians, especially, that he might not yet be centrist enough.
Explain a bit, if you will, how that works in the parliamentary system, and if there is a weak government because he doesn't have a majority in the parliament, what does he have to do in order to get enough votes to be able to govern?
Well, it's just like imagine having the president and his cabinet sitting inside Congress, and every time the president wanted to pass a bill, Congress had to vote on that bill, and if the Congress didn't pass the bill, the government fell and we had an election. It's the British Westminster tradition. Australia
sure.
has it, of course, and others. The first thing he has to do is he has to meet the House of Commons, probably in March, and pass a throne speech. A speech from the throne is very much like a State of the Union address, except, again, Congress votes on the State of the Union address, and if the vote is defeated, the government falls. The government will not fall on the throne speech, and it will not fall on the budget, which will then follow. And those are the two really critical things.
Mm-hmm.
The one lays out the agenda, the other lays out the financing. And it won't fall because the Bloc Québécois, which is the party that represents the forces of Quebec sovereignty in Quebec, actually lost seats in this campaign. The New Democratic Party, which is the truly left-wing social democratic party, very much like a European social democratic party, did well, but it only gained a small number of seats, not enough to hold the balance of power. And the Liberal Party is in disarray. Prime Minister Paul Martin not only conceded defeat last night, but he resigned as leader of the party. So the Liberals are going to have to go into a leadership campaign, and they won't want to force a premature election. And this is, you know, usually Canada gets stable majority governments and then enters into a period of minority governments leading to another stable majority government. We seem to be in a prolonged period of unstable minorities right now. And we just went through a winter campaign, and let me tell you, having spent 8 weeks on the road, nobody wants to go through another winter campaign in Canada again. So I'm fairly confident the government will last a year, 18 months at least, even though the situation is unstable, and I pray to God that it happens next time in June.
I can certainly understand that, knowing a little bit about the weather in Canada. Again, Paul Martin was also hampered, I gather, by the fact that there were political scandals going on. We don't really have time to go into that. Let me ask you again, John Ibbotson with the Globe and Mail, what about relations with the United States, particularly with regard to missile defense?
Yeah, the one thing that this really will do will result in an improved relations with the U.S. Stephen Harper is a lot of things. One of the things he's a Westerner. He was born in Ontario, but he spent his adult life in Calgary. And the West tends to be more pro-American. Well, let's put it this way. The West tends to be, the Prairies especially, tend to be more pro-Southern American. That is to say, while Ontario and Quebec and the Maritimes feel strong ties to the Northeast, and while British Columbia feels strong ties to California and Oregon and Washington, the Prairies, where Harper comes from, are very much the party of Texas, the party of the Midwest and of the South. And Harper has, just as Prime Minister Paul Martin campaigned on a Canada has to keep its distance from the United States, Stephen Harper said, we'll keep our distance, but it's nuts for us to think that we can keep that much distance. After all, the two countries have the largest trading relationship in the world and the world's longest undefended border. So he will, for example, probably symbolically enter into negotiations on the missile defense program. You'll never cite a radar base here. You'll never cite a missile here. But NORAD, which the Canadians and the Americans jointly share command of, will take more responsibility for the program itself. Canada will work more aggressively to ensure border security. One of the things that he's doing is he's proposing a very large increase in the expansion of the Canadian Defense Forces, the Canadian Army and Navy and Air Force, which the Americans will like, and which will also lead to increased security of our borders and in the Arctic as well. He's big on projecting Canadian Arctic sovereignty. So those are all things the White House should feel very comfortable with.
We've got about 20 seconds left. What about the Kyoto Treaty?
Canada, he will not withdraw from the Kyoto Treaty. He just won't live up to it. And that's a symbol more than a substance. The United States never signed the Kyoto Treaty. Nonetheless, it's had a much better record of reducing carbon dioxide emissions than Canada has. Canada signed it, but the Liberal government never did, in fact, put together a program that would actually allow us to meet our targets. And we will not meet those targets. We will fail. All Harper is saying is that let's admit that we're going to fail and see what we can do on an incremental basis to actually improve the situation.
Well, thank you very much for being with us and giving us a good tour of Canadian politics as well as relations with the United States. Good to have you with us.
It was a pleasure. Thanks.
John Ibbotson, again, political columnist for The Globe and Mail in Canada, where they now have or are about to have, as we heard, a new government. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Cameron Radziner and Andrea Brody. Technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.